Blog Talk Radio.
Rhyme ruler, the mind of the master, the prime poet designed for disaster, a crime candidate, the light heavyweight, I might levitate right through the heaven's gate, rhymes record break neck spines and vertebrae, step on the plane like Kanye, I heard him say, it's murder one when he murder tracks, I'm a dirtbag, flirting with songbirds and Birkin bags, my first rap catch Roberta Flack, I'm a certified Mac, but I'm sure you ain't heard of that. Slim Thug and them hoes, they been loving the flow. They been hunting for men like In Vogue, and I'm in season, the season vet. I don't need respect.
All right, all welcome into the newest edition of the Chip Williams Podcast featuring Joe Monack. I usually don't have intro music, but I stole yours. I thought it would be a proper introduction for the great Joe Monack. How are you today, sir?
I was about to say, I thought I've listened to your show a couple of times, the one with you and Jonah, and then another one that you and you had the Kevin Hughes guy on, and I didn't think that you led with Sly, but yeah, okay, I appreciate the intro, I like that. A shout out to the flagship show of our Blog Talk Radio airwaves, Grizzly Bear Blues Live, but as Chip and I have had conversations in the past, I'm pretty excited that you've taken on this second show. And I've noticed it's growing in popularity, Chip. You're doing a good job kind of spreading your wings with this show. Maybe you'll get the Joe Monack bump here, arguably your biggest guest to this point, at least in terms of biggest ego and largest head in terms of physical circumference of the head.
I'm not sure there's much argument it's the biggest guest. I think – I don't know what the proper gauge is for how popular a guest is. But you definitely have the most Twitter followers, if that means anything.
There you go.
Of any guests that
there
I've had
go.
On. So
whatever
the one measuring
that
stick.
Yeah.
Yeah, for what that's worth, right?
For
whatever
what
that's worth. So
and positive so. At least it's, there's no bots. I make sure I go through there's a legit 1,085 at the current moment. No bots.
Oh, so
no
you,
bots
you, you go kick the bots out.
I kick the bots out. I don't want to see the fake boobies and all that stuff. Like, there's a couple, actually, I'm misspeaking. I need to block as I sit here. I'm not interested in Inga Hansen and her boobies hanging out. I'm just going to go ahead and get rid of this.
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes I'll tweet an article out, and then a week later, all of a sudden, like, it gets three favorites, and I look, and it's all three pictures of attractive women. My ego got a little boosted. Like, somebody found an article of mine and all of a sudden liked it, but then I'm like, oh, well, never mind. not as good as I thought it was going to be.
I've been slacking, apparently. I just looked at my follower. I had four of them recently. Goodness gracious. So now I'm at 1,081. But at least it's a legit 1,081, Chip. And I'm excited to be here and be a guest on the Blog Talk Radio airwaves of ours for the first time. This will be fun.
Yeah, this will be fun. So, obviously, there's, a thousand things I want to talk to you about. But I kind of want to start, before we jump into the reason everybody's here listening, and talk about the Grizzlies. So, I got to ask, college basketball, it just kind of started up. I know, a lot of teams have played two or three games up to this point. But, ESPN does their 24 hours of college hoops. And I think that's probably when everybody starts to take notice. That's kind of when college basketball is back on your early week games, like your Tuesdays, your Mondays, your Wednesdays. That's kind of when college basketball starts to come back in. So are you a guy that pays attention to college basketball at all?
I am. I follow the UVA, the Virginia Cavaliers, pretty closely, much to the displeasure of my wife and her family. They're Virginia Tech Hokie fans, but thankfully Virginia Tech people, they don't really acknowledge any other sport but football. They see the basketball gymnasium and they just think it's another indoor practice facility for the football team. So it's a situation where they're not as mad at me about supporting UVA basketball. I keep the UVA football stuff under wraps. The Hokie football, I let that slide, of course. And they're so nice to allow me to take part in their Hokiedom during football season. But with college basketball, follow UVA pretty closely, and they had a tough loss against George Washington last night, one that worries me a little bit because UVA, much like the Memphis Grizzlies, their calling card is their defense, and it looked pretty lacking. And they have some new faces. They have some guys taking on new roles. Malcolm Brogdon and Anthony Gill are two that jump out that, you know, are kind of stepping up in terms of importance. And they just didn't rise to the challenge last night defensively. London Parentis is another guy who needs to step it up a little bit. And I believe that UVA is starting, his last name might be Thompson, a Tennessee transfer. He came to the Volunteers, and now he's at Virginia, and he starts for them. And so they have some new faces, some guys, and some new places, and they kind of have to match up and adjust. I do watch the 24 hours of college basketball that ESPN does. It's one of my favorite sports days of the year, actually. I think it's pretty cool that they have, like, 3 a.m. games and stuff like that. That would be, I think, back to my college experience, if I had gone to a bigger school, and that would have been pretty neat, you know. If there's a 2 a.m. basketball game. You want to go? Hell yeah, I want to go. Let's go. That'd be pretty neat to be a part of. And I did watch a little bit of the Memphis-Oklahoma game, and that was pretty good. The Tigers are different this year in a positive way, so that's good to see. And after all the negativity with Austin Nichols, it's good that the Tigers have a little bit of a positive mojo coming out of that game in particular.
So that begs the question, how excited are your fellow UVA fans about Austin Nichols next season?
They're pretty excited about him. He's going to be pretty good, and he slides right in. Anthony Gill, who I mentioned earlier, is a power forward, but he's also a fifth-year senior, so he's gone after this season. So Nichols will slide right into that starting power forward spot, one would imagine. And then you'll also have London Parente still back. You'll have Mike Toby back. And UVA's recruiting classes aren't obviously to the level of UNC or Duke or Kansas or somebody like that. But they're second tier in terms of recruiting, so they bring in some pretty good players to play Tony Bennett's scheme. So it'll be fun to watch him in UVA blue and orange. And obviously Memphis, it sounds like from watching a little bit of the game, they're doing a little more run-and-gun kind of style this season, which suits their personnel with the Tigers. UVA is the opposite of that. They will bleed the clock. They will play intense defense. I think Austin Nichols will thrive in that system.
Could not agree more. I think that Austin is going from, you know, a system in Memphis that I don't know that it doesn't fit him, because I think he's so good that he can make himself work in just about any system. But he is going to a place that, you know, where he's going to be able to be the rim protector that he needs to be, because he's elite at that. And it's a slow it down, kind of grind it out pace that UVA plays. It's not what Memphis plays. So I think that that's a better situation for him. Honestly, seeing what Dedrick Lawson did against Oklahoma, that seems like an okay situation for those guys as well, because Dedrick, now that opens up the spot for him to play that starting power forward position. So just curious, you know, I know a lot of NBA guys are not huge on college basketball because the quality of basketball, for the most part, is bad. I mean, it is really not fun to watch if you're a guy that enjoys kind of a smooth basketball game. I think that you know, that's kind of a discussion that you could really jump into in terms of, you know, is that a product of the one-and-done system or whatever. But we'll move on to some Grizz stuff. I was just kind of curious about that. So you wrote a Jeff Green feature today. Jeff
another
Green has
been called out. I don't know if you saw that. I've been called out for writing another Jeff Green feature.
Oh, no.
Well,
people
in fairness, I do kind of love him.
No, that's fair. That's why I ask you about this kind of stuff. So Jeff Green is a polarizing guy. I mean, I don't think there's any other way to say it. There's people there's not a lot of fence riders with Jeff Green, you know. There's kind of that really dislike him, and there's kind of guys that, you know, root for him. And I think root for him to do well and certainly see that potential that's there. So I'm just curious. You basically, I guess, the subject of your article was trying to figure out, you know, which Jeff Green is the real Jeff Green, and I'm curious what the conclusion was that you came to.
Well, the conclusion was that, as you said very well there, Chip, you've got some guys who feel, or some guys or girls, there's female Grizzly fans who despise and love and, you know, go back and forth. So it goes across genders here, this hatred or love of Jeff Green. And the beautiful thing about Jeff Green is, and I mentioned this in the article, he does a little bit of everything to make everybody right and everybody wrong. He'll have games like he has the past few where he'll look fantastic on offense. He'll do exactly what we've always wanted him to do as Grizzlies fans and bloggers and media types. And he'll get to the corner and shoot the three, and he'll drive to the basket in transition. And he'll, you know, do the things that he's best at without, you know, just lazily pulling up for jumpers. And then there will be times, and I detail this in the article, which is where I thought I was a little bit different than what I've done in the past. I blatantly rip Jeff Green for his defense, and I use screenshots, a couple of examples against Golden State, where he just is completely lost. He loses Andre Iguodala entirely on one possession. Another one, he's in the paint, leaving Harrison Barnes wide open, 15 or 20 feet away, and he doesn't replace. It's just kind of a lazy attempt to get back to the shot, and Barnes is wide open. It's a guy who makes everybody right and wrong. He is tremendously talented, amazing athlete, does things in terms of dunking the basketball that not many other people in the league can do. You know, LeBron James comes to mind, Blake Griffin, and he's certainly not in those categories. In terms of in-game dunking, he's right up there with an unfortunate comparison to Memphis Grizzlies fans, Rudy Gay. He's that guy. He can be that kind of talent. He also can be inefficient scoring the basketball. He also can be a guy who lazily, as I said earlier, pulls up on mid-range jumpers. He's a guy who Dave Yeager, the past couple of games, according to reports, Pete Planica said this on the broadcast the other night, he's being started right now for Courtney Lee because of matchups, because they want to start him for defensive reasons in terms of length and size. But that's extremely confusing if you actually watch the games consistently, because it looks like he's a guy that has no idea what he's doing defensively half the time. Maybe if you pull a Tony Allen, you say that's your man, you stay with him, he might be a little bit better. But he's not the defender that Courtney Lee is in terms of actual defensive skill. So the gist of the article, Chip, was everybody's right. If you think he's terrible, well, yeah, there are times where he's absolutely terrible. If you think he's great, there's times where he's great. I think it'd be hard to argue against him playing well the past couple of games. I think it'd be really hard to say he was terrible the past two or three. I think it, you know, is much easier to argue he played very well to great, especially offensively. You could say his defense was a struggle, but for the Grizzlies against Oklahoma City, defense in general was a struggle. So I don't know if that's a fair critique of him individually. But the overall tone of the article was he's a professional athlete, so he should be able to take these situations in stride. But he is whatever you want him to be. He is an offensive presence when he wants to be. He is a defensive liability when he unfortunately needs to be better. He is whatever Grizzlies fans want him to be, and that was kind of the tone of the article.
Well, so who does that fall on then? Does that fall on Jeff being, you know, hey, Jeff, you got to make these decisions where, you know, you can't pull up for this jump shot. You got to go to the rim. Is that on Jeff Green, the player? Is that on Dave Yeager, the coach? Is that on the leaders of the Grizzlies team? Is that on Mark Gasol, Zach Randolph, Mike Conley? Whose responsibility is that? Whose responsibility is it to make sure that Jeff Green plays the role that he's supposed to play?
Well, I think it would be unfair to completely leave Dave Yeager out of it, because as a coach, you install scheme, you install game plan, it's your job to put guys in position to be successful. If you put them in a position to be a failure, then that's on you. That's not on the guy. That's not, you know, that's from Pee Wee all the way through the professional ranks and everything in between. If I, as a high school football defensive coordinator, personnel notwithstanding, if I have a kid playing nose tackle who's 180 pounds, I'm setting that kid up for failure, if that makes sense, using a football analogy.
Right.
I'm putting a kid who should be a defensive back or a linebacker in the trenches going against 270-pound guys. He's not being set up for success. It's up to Dave Yeager to set up Jeff Green for success. He has to put him in sets where he is naturally going to glide to that corner three, which is, you could certainly argue, is the only place that he should be shooting three-point shots. He has to be put into spots where it is advantageous for him to drive to the basket. So that's a little bit on Dave Yeager. But at the same time, Jeff Green, I believe, is 29 years old. He's played for multiple NBA coaches now, multiple NBA teams. At some point, he also needs to take responsibility and say, you know, I just kind of am what I am as a player, and I'm not doing what I should be doing professionally that plays to my strengths. whether it's him just choosing not to, whether it's him not fully understanding that in terms of basketball IQ, and I think you can make an argument for that being part of it because of the way that he defends. To me, it's a cop-out when people make the argument, and they did it for Ed Davis, and they did it for Rudy Gay. Oh, he's just lazy. He looks disinterested. I don't really think that – I think that's trying to oversimplify. I think these are guys who maybe are confused with scheme, who don't quite understand it. And, again, you can put that on the professional basketball player for not doing their job the best that they can and not putting in the time maybe that, say, a Tony Allen does in terms of film study and knowing what your opponent is going to throw at you. But I don't think it's disinterest. I don't think it's a lack of caring. I think it's a lack of understanding for whatever reason. He clearly has the physical tools to do these things. He just doesn't execute them, especially on the defensive end of the floor, the way that he should. So I think that it's a mixed bag. I don't know if you can blame the players on the roster. They have their own problems. Mike Conley is just now getting out of a funk that he's been in most of the season. Marc Gasol is getting himself into shape. Zach Randolph has been somewhat steady, but, you know, he's also started to be picked on a little bit for his deficiencies in terms of his size and the way the teams play the four position in the NBA now. So the Grizzlies at large, at some point as a professional, you need to take responsibility for yourself. And Jeff Green, he does that to an extent, but at the same time, you look at the baseline of his career, and it kind of ties in with what I said in the article. He is what you want him to be. If you want to focus on the positives, there's positives there. When he's aggressive, he can finish at the rim well. When he has good shot selection, he's an efficient basketball player. But he also can make terrible shot selection choices, and he can defend extremely poorly at times. He is whatever you see him as, and whatever your bias is towards him, you can back it up with both visual evidence and numerical evidence, depending on the time period and the game stretch that you're comparing him to. It's a game-by-game, five-game stretch with him at this point. And I think that at this point, a majority of that blame has to be placed on Jeff.
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, if you looked at it before Mario Chalmers got here, you could have made the argument that there was really no reason that Jeff Green should be in the rotation. He was playing that poorly. I mean, it was bad watching him play basketball. I mean, he was pulling up for ill-advised mid-range jump shots. He was losing guys on defense. I mean, he was a net negative. There was no reason for him to be playing. And then ever since Chalmers has gotten here, not only has the team played better, but Jeff Green, he's gone for back-to-back 20-point nights. He looks more engaged. His shot's falling. He's being an efficient scorer. He's getting to the line. Defensively, he doesn't look like a liability. It is incredible the way that this guy can just go from someone who, you know, has all the physical tools, all the physical talent in the world, and watch him go from being basically a player that has no business being out on an NBA court to a player that looks like, you know, I don't know, a borderline all-star is fair, but he looks fantastic. I mean, he's been great the last couple of nights. And, listen, the record shows that out. The Grizzlies are 5-0 when Jeff Green scores double figures, and I think 1-6 when he doesn't. That tells me that they are good when Jeff Green's good, right? I mean, I'm stating the obvious, basically. But that tells me that it's just such a massive bonus when Jeff Green is who they brought him here to be, basically. And whether that's fair to make that assumption that Jeff Green is all of a sudden going to be the starting level three that you hope he can be, I don't know that that's fair. But so I'll ask you, which Jeff Green can we expect? I mean, is this just what it is now? Is it going to be five games on, five games off, five games on, five games off? Or can we find some kind of medium to where, you know, maybe Jeff's scoring 12, 13 a game?
I think he's going to settle into the medium, Chip. He's not going to be as bad as he was the first nine games because his career numbers don't back that up. And I said on GBB Live, I've had an opportunity to do a couple of different appearances on Three Shades of Blue Radio over the weekend and then on the Baseline podcast with Cal and Warren. And people have asked similar questions of me. And I'm a big believer in the law of averages. And I know you are as well. We've talked about this when you were with me on GBB Live last season. They're not going to be as bad as they were. He was shooting 34.9%. And this is from my article from today, or from Tuesday. He was shooting 34.9% from the field the first nine games. The past three, he's shooting 45.7%. That's more in line overall with what he's done for his career. He scored 18.3 points a game. His offensive rating has jumped up by a whopping 27.2. His net rating has improved by almost, goodness gracious, almost 18 or 17 overall. His true shooting percentage is 20 points better or 20 percentage points better. And the major number to me, Chip, is his minutes per game have gone up. Obviously, he started in the past couple of games, but he has gone from 22.3 minutes per game in the first nine to 33.1 in the last three. And as I was doing research for this article last night at 1 in the morning, again, to the detriment of my sleeping schedule, but, you know, the blogger grind is real, I guess. 33.1 minutes per game, that's a large jump. And he's getting time that maybe he didn't see earlier in the year when he was struggling. And that, to me, Chip, is promising in that it showcases one thing to me, that Dave Joerger is willing to have a short leash with the guy. He's going to play him because, and Matt Arlicka, our own GBB's own Matt Arlicka, and others on Twitter have had this conversation. You know, if you're talking Jeff Green in the grand scheme of things as a seventh man, eighth man, ninth man off the bench, a rotation player, he's one of the best rotation players in the NBA. It all comes down to your expectations of the guy. If you think he's going to be a starter, as we were talking about and as you said a moment ago, is that a fair expectation of him to score 18 points a game and shoot 45.7% or better all the time? No, that's not fair. His career doesn't bear that out. If that is your expectation of him, you are going to be disappointed. On the flip side, I think that the floor that Matt offers is a little bit low. If Jeff Green is your eighth or ninth rotation guy, and he's coming in and he's only giving you 17 minutes a game between two forwards, typically underachieving for him, and you're not utilizing him as well as you can. To me, whether it's as a starter and you just curtail his minutes a little bit like you would with a Tony Allen, or whether it's as a guy coming off the bench in a six-man kind of role, settling in right around that 25, 26 minutes a game, you expect him to settle around his career averages, giving you 12 or 13 points a night. Between him, between Mario Chalmers, between Matt Barnes, who's done well defensively, still finding his shot consistently, but he's a guy that you can count on in terms of veteran presence. These are guys that you can count on in terms of running the offense, running up and down in transition with that second unit. It's fun to watch the Mario Chalmers guy play, the Mario Chalmers line play, because, and Mike Conley said this at the end of the broadcast last night, or he said it in an interview, they get out and run. You know, it's good for him. It's good for Jeff. It opens up lanes because they're able to get out and run a little bit more than they would have been able to before not just Mario's arrival, but before Jeff Green kind of found his swing the past few games. So I think the middle ground is where we can safely say Jeff will land. I'm not sure that he'll completely drop back to where he was the first nine games. I do think that was probably his floor for the season. But I think a cooling off period is undoubtedly going to happen. When that happens, my guess would be the San Antonio game Saturday night, because you got Greg Popovich. He's going to know how to defend these Grizzlies. He's going to have several games of tape of Mario Chalmers at this point. I think that'll probably be the night where you see Memphis's offense cool down a little bit. Houston's having some problems, so I don't necessarily see them slowing down Memphis, especially in a home game. But the second night of a back-to-back in San Antonio, that might be where we see a regression back to the mean.
You know, I think the reason, Joerger has been extremely adamant about continuing to play Jeff Green. I think sometimes unjustifiably so. I mean, there have just been times, like I said, he has not looked good at all, but sure. Joerger continues to play it. And here's the reason I think that that's so. I think Dave Joerger realizes that Green is playing like he has played the last three games. That elevates the Grizzlies' ceiling to the next level. I mean, it just kind of notches them up. I mean, if you look at the starting wing combination of Courtney Lee and Tony Allen, there's only so much that starting wing combination can do in terms of a ceiling. I think the Grizzlies have probably touched that ceiling, and I'm not sure they're going to get a whole lot higher than that. But with a guy like Jeff Green, who's giving you 15 to 18 points a night and doing that relatively efficiently, that's just another added dimension. And I think Joerger realizes that if he can get any semblance of consistency this Grizzlies team, it elevates them. It makes them that much better and that much tougher to deal with, because you know you're going to get Mike, you're going to get Mark, you're going to get Zach. Now, you know, you expect you're going to get Tony at least 25 a game, and you know what he's going to give you. But then if you're talking about getting a couple of threes out of Jeff Green and 15 points and, you know, even just competent defense with the other guys that are out there, I just think that does something for this team's ceiling. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And even if it's not a three-point shot, Chip, it's just as simple as shot distribution, as I said earlier from the article again today. The first nine games of the season, only 31.7% of his shots were at or around the rim to begin the season. And that's way too low. He needs to be around 50-50. And if you look at his percentages from the past three games, he actually has taken, you know, a vast majority of his shots, 60% of them, at or around the rim. He took more shots, Chip, at or around the rim in the past three games than he did in the previous nine. He took 20 in the first nine games of the season at or around the rim, and he took 21 in the past three. So that means he's aggressive. That means he's attacking the basket. That means he's getting to the free throw line. He's an exceptional free throw shooter. And that is where you get the most efficient version of Jeff. When he's getting to the free throw line, when he's finding ways to use his size, use his length and athleticism to create off the dribble. And also when he's playing that small ball four, you're going to get a lot of mismatches there. There's not many guys that are a small ball four. More often than not, you might have a few athletes here. A Thad Young comes to mind, or obviously a Draymond Green. But, you know, a lot of times your small ball fours are guys like a Ryan Anderson, who, you know, they're in there for spacing purposes, or a Dirk Nowitzki. They're not going to be able to defend Jeff Green off the dribble. They're just not going to be able to do it. So that's a mismatch that you can create. And that's the nice thing about having a Jeff Green, having a Matt Barnes, having a Mario Chalmers, who can play multiple positions, both in the front court and the back court. It allows for you to, and again, credit to Dave Joerger, I don't know if I agree with the way he's executing it, but he's playing matchups, in his opinion. He's doing what he thinks he can do using the malleable pieces of this roster, and he's making them fit in a way that to create mismatches. The fact that Mario Chalmers can defend multiple backcourt positions is huge. That's gigantic, because it allows Chalmers and Conley to play together. That gives Conley more opportunity to play off the ball and score the ball in a variety of different ways that he can't do as a ball-dominant guard. Jeff Green is the same way. If you have him at the four, that gives him an opportunity to take advantage of mismatches. If you have him as a point forward, that gives him a chance to create for others, which he's done pretty well this season overall. But it also gives him a chance to play with the ball in his hands and kind of feel like he's running the offense. It gives him a little bit more responsibility, and it maybe makes him a little bit more invested, not just in what he's doing in the offense, but what his teammates are. And he's a guy who's a team-first guy. I think he's proven that, the fact that he moved himself to the bench last season because he thought it was best for the team, and the team thought it was best for the team, but he did it himself. You know, that kind of showcases he wants to do what's best for the squad. And what's best for the squad is for Jeff Green to attack the freaking basket and get to the free throw line. And I do think that is something that version of Jeff Green is the kind of guy that is going to get Memphis consistently in the conversation again with the best teams in the West. Right now, their record is what it is. They're 6-6. They're a mediocre basketball team, but they're on the upward trend. Whereas a week and a half ago, everybody was screaming at the sky to stop falling. This is a much better place to be at.
Well, I thought it was interesting last night in the locker room. Jeff, you know, he's just asked about it because obviously he had a good game. All the media wanted to talk to him, and he said, I'm paraphrasing, but basically he said, listen, I understand what I have to do, and that's be aggressive, and that's get to the rim anytime that I possibly can and take threes when they're presented to me. And, I don't know if that's just him saying that, but that certainly shows me a self-awareness of I know what I need to do, and I'm going to start doing that. Now, I'm not going to sit here and talk myself into the fact that Jeff Green is all of a sudden going to become an extremely efficient player on both ends of the floor, whatever. But just the fact that he would say something like that makes me know that he is starting to at least comprehend what everybody has said. You know, and it's probably what everybody has said throughout his whole career. I mean, I'll be honest, I haven't followed his career, you know, extremely closely until he got here to Memphis. I always knew who he was. I knew that people kind of referred to him as an inefficient guy, but you know, I would imagine that every stop he's been, people said, listen, Jeff, if you do these two things, you can be an extremely useful basketball player. So I want to move on from Jeff Green, but anytime I get to talk to Joe Mullinex, I have to talk about Jeff Green because it's always fun. I think you're fair. I will say that you're fair. I know you root for Jeff to do well, and that's because you want the Grizzlies to do well. But at the end of the day, I think you're fair, and I think you would recognize that Jeff has plenty of shortcomings. He has as many shortcomings as any player on this Grizzlies roster in terms of just making boneheaded plays or just doing some boneheaded things that just make you say, why, Jeff? And it's frustrating because we all recognize the talent is absolutely there. That has never been a question. It's just a matter of kind of harnessing it all in and making sure that he understands what he has to do. So I do want to ask you about Mario Chalmers. Final words on Jeff. Sure.
Final thing on Jeff, because somebody, like I said, the guy on the actual article commented another Jeff Green article, which I thought was funny because I have written a few. Somebody on Twitter, Stevie Danziger, who writes for Three Shades of Blue, he retweeted the article and said that Joe and Jeff Green will forever be linked at the hip, and I thought that was funny too. There's a perception of me as a Jeff Green guy, and there's a couple of reasons for this. One, I have a soft spot for guys that are from where I'm from. Jeff Green's from the DMV, D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. You know, played Georgetown. I followed his career. So I've always liked Jeff in that way. But also, as I said in a comment to the guy who said another Jeff Green article on the site, which, again, in fairness, yes, there has been a few. I love a good story. I'm a sucker for a good story, and I love the story of Zach Randolph. You won't find many people in Grizzly Bloggerdom that have been more critical of Zach Randolph over the past few years than me. But I love Zach's story. He has taken himself and completely transformed his image. I mean, this is a guy who was a jailblazer, and now he's a hero. And I talked about that in the Friday 3 last week. He's legitimately a hero to so many people in Memphis. That's an awesome story. Jeff Green's heart surgery and his coming back from that and his working with kids who face similar issues, that's a hell of a story. And no, that shouldn't have any relevance to him as a professional basketball player. You need to perform. But I just love the story. And I think that the fact that he does that and the journey as a person and as a basketball player is fascinating to me. So that's one of the reasons I love Jeff Green. I love the story of Jeff and what he's been through to get to where he is as a average to below average NBA basketball player.
No, I'm with you. I root for Memphis kids. I will gladly tell you that. I'll tell anybody that. It doesn't matter if you went to the University of Memphis or if you went to Kentucky, like Sky Labissiere.
Sure.
I am going to root for Memphis kids to do well. And you root for good stories. I mean, you just do. You want them to be successful. So, but from a story standpoint, and I understand from you being where you're from, it's completely understandable to want Jeff Green to be successful. I mean, I think anybody that lives anywhere and has someone that is a tremendous athlete come through that town or that city, they're going to root for their success. I mean, it's natural, I think. Completely understand that. So, Mario Chalmers, you ready to go ahead and give him Sixth Man of the Year award?
Well, our own Beale Street Ken put out a poll today on the site, and I gave him a hard time, a little bit of a razzing on Twitter. I said, I'm kind of upset that Hall of Famer wasn't an option for what our expectations of Mario Chalmers is the rest of the way. He's been tremendous. He really has, Chip. He's been a fantastic breath of fresh air. And I think that more than anything, obviously we've talked about the skill set, his willingness to shoot threes, defend multiple positions. I've talked about that. You've talked about that. Everybody on the blog has talked about that. Chris Harrington, Kevin Light, that's been analyzed. If you follow the Grizzlies at all, you have read somebody saying something about that. To me, something that's not talked about as much, or at least I haven't seen it as much yet, is the breath of fresh air in terms of attitude and in terms of energy. Here's a guy who's legitimately pissed off, Chip. He's not happy.
Yeah.
Don't get it twisted. He's happy to be in Memphis because it's an opportunity to be in an actual role, and he's going to be on a team that's more than likely, even after the slow start, going to make the playoffs. he's excited to be in Memphis for those reasons. But he's pissed off that he's not in Miami. And he's pissed off the way that it ended in Miami. And he plays pissed off. And I think that energy and that tenacity has fed into the team. You can see the energy flow through these guys. And Dave Yeager, I know you covered the game. He talked about it, the fact that it was the third game in four nights, and they played their asses off, man. And it was awesome to watch the way these guys flew around. It was a playoff atmosphere in November. I mean, you can't ask for much more than that as an NBA fan, whether it's a casual fan or whether it's a follower of the team like you and I. So his energy and his tenacity and his fire, and you could see it after a made three where he yelled an expletive. If you're a mouth reader, you can figure out what he said. But, I mean, I love that, man. I mean, it's awesome to see a competitor, to see a guy who's legitimately mad at what happened to him or what he perceived happened to him. Obviously, two sides to every story. But he has come to Memphis, and he has embraced this new role, and he's embraced this opportunity. And he's a guy who, to me, he isn't a breath of, you know, he isn't a savior in terms of his ability. He's another guy who's going to regress back to the mean. He's not going to play this way all season. If you honestly think that, you're out of your mind. But he is a guy, again, give you 10 to 12 points a night on average. He's a guy who can give you energy. If he can maintain this level of aggression and fire, Chip, which is the hardest thing to do through an 82-game schedule. If he can find a way to keep that up for these Grizzlies, that is his biggest contribution to me, is the fact that he's playing with a chip on his shoulder and that energy is contagious.
So a couple of things. One, first I'll say the game against Oklahoma City was just flat out one of the most fun basketball games I've ever been to, just even as a neutral observer. But as someone who, generally speaking, has a rooting interest in the Grizzlies winning, first of all, you got that. You got a Grizzlies win. Second of all, you got to see Russell Westbrook at his very best. I mean, the guy had 40 points and was just doing things that, I mean, there are maybe three or four basketball players in the world that can do some of the things he does when he's locked in. I mean, it is incredible to watch. But you also got to see Mario Chalmers score 29 points and do it where, I mean, he had that place rocking. I mean, it was fantastic to see, because it's something that, if you look at what these two entities were, you know, Mario Chalmers was a guy who had a terrible season in 2014-15 and had an even worse start to this season. And so I think the narrative started to become, okay, he was just a product of the superstars that he played with. That's the reason that he had any kind of numbers at all, because people were not paying attention to him. And I do think that there is some truth to that. I mean, it's natural. Anybody that plays with LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, you're probably going to have your best years, because they're not paying a whole lot of attention to you. I do think there is some truth to that. But if you look at what he's done for the Grizzlies, it's back to what the old Mario Chalmers was able to do. He's able to play a little bit off the ball. He's able to run the show when he needs to. He's able to give Mike Conley some rest. And you look at what the kind of shot in the arm it's been for the Grizzlies. I mean, this team, people were ready to write him off. People were very happy to say, all right, get rid of Tony, get rid of Zach. This is done. This run is over. And listen, it looked that bad at some points in this season. I realized I was always one that it's early, we'll kind of reevaluate a little bit later, but this does not look good. And there are still problems. This team is not perfect. But just the shot in the arm, the way he's raised the play of Mike Conley, the way he's raised the play of even Jeff Green, the way the guy's played in the three games Chalmers has been there, the way he's raised the game, you know, Courtney Lee has not looked bad, even coming off the bench in the couple of games that he had. Zach Randolph looks fine. JerMichael Green looks fine. It is the way that his energy has brought to this team. It's something like, you know, you see it in baseball sometimes. They'll make a deal at the deadline, a playoff team will, just to give that team the extra push going forward, just to give them kind of the extra jolt. And I think the Grizzlies needed something like that. So my question for you would be, we are both completely in agreement that Mario Chalmers is not going to average just south of 20 points a game for the rest of the time he's here. So, number one, how long can he keep this up? And number two, once those numbers kind of settle to where the season average is going to look like, what will those numbers look like?
Well, again, maybe I just have a permanent fear and traumatizing experience with the Spurs. I think the Grizzlies will kind of come back down to earth at the Spurs game. I think they'll beat the Rockets, and we'll talk about this on Grizzly Bear Blues Live on Thursday night in our preview piece. I think they'll beat the Rockets. The Rockets are a train wreck right now. I think Memphis will continue to ride that high of being at home. It'll probably be another decent Chalmers game. I think Jeff will have another good performance. They're feeling it right now. But, again, you go to San Antonio, second game of a back-to-back, you're probably going to get punched in the face a little bit. So my guess is that the coming back to earth will happen in San Antonio. And to be honest with you, Chip, that's okay. I mean, the team would go 53-29. That was my official prediction at the beginning of the year, before any games were actually played. And you look at the schedule and the way that things have all turned out, and again, credit to Matt Arlica, who said this on Twitter, I believe, or maybe it was on the blog, but outside of maybe arguably the Portland game at Portland, you look at their schedule, that's the only game that you could say you expected them to win that they lost. So right now they're sitting at 6-6. If you're being logical with predictions, 7-5 is what they should be. And if you're 10-8 at the end of this stretch, that's successful because it was a hell of a start to the season. 12 of their first 18 games were against 2015 playoff teams. They played Golden State twice in that stretch. They're going to see in the next, you know, six games, Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Houston, Atlanta, and then they end with Philadelphia. So if they go 3-3 in this stretch, if they go 9-9 in these first 18 games, Chip, that's a victory, man. I mean, that's a victory. I declare victory. As a follower of the team, blogger for the team, podcaster, I'm saying, hell yes, they're 9-9. Let's get to December and January where the schedule lightens up a little bit and run off some wins, especially in the Western Conference that isn't at the bottom nearly as menacing as we thought it would be. Obviously, Golden State is in an entirely different stratosphere. San Antonio is playing very well, as we just talked about. But after that, nobody scares you right now. I mean, nobody. So they're a team that can come out and compete with anybody outside of those two. They can run off some wins if they continue to play close to this level. And I think that San Antonio will probably be the first kind of snap back to reality moment for them, whether it be Chalmers, whether it be Green, whoever it is that's playing well for Memphis at the moment. Pop and the Spurs have a funny way of snapping you out of your daydream and delusions of grandeur.
Right. I remember at one point in the preseason, Dave Yeager saying that something to the effect of if they were 14-11 through 25 games, he'd consider that a victory. And if you look at the schedule through the first 25 games, I mean, it's hard to disagree with them. I mean, you know, Grizzlies fans expect to be better than 14-11. But I think you take that, and then you just assume that the schedule is going to ease up a little bit, and you're going to be able to reel off some wins, you know, as you kind of move forward. And that's not ideal. I think ideally you'd love to jump out to the fast start like you did last season. You'd love to rest some guys, although the Grizzlies had to really hold on to the rope to not let it slip too far last season. So who knows? I mean, you know, whatever. You just kind of keep your head above water right now because a lot of teams are trying to do the same, and then you start to make that run later on. End of the season. So last thing I want to ask you about Mario Chalmers. Mike Conley, I'm going to read you what he said last night about him. He said, Mario Chalmers is going to help my game a lot. Even for the few minutes we got to play together each game, I think we've really got the gel. I think we play well together. We're able to find each other. I'm not having to worry about bringing the ball up the court. I can just play basketball. It gives us a different dynamic. So that's the thing about Mike Conley and Mario Chalmers, is they're both very comfortable with the ball not in their hands or with the ball in their hands. Either one, they're fine with it, I think, because they're both good spot-up shooters. They can both facilitate with or without the ball. They both move relatively well also without the ball. So how much does that help Mike Conley, bringing in a guy like Mario Chalmers, since we know Dave Yeager likes to use the two-point guard lineups?
Well, I think Mike Conley will be the biggest long-term benefactor of the arrival of Mario Chalmers. And I talked about that in the Friday 3 last week, and I even got to use some Latin, and I was disappointed that people didn't appreciate my Latin usage as much, but I digress. He's the guy, I think, that's going to benefit the most because of the fact that, again, no offense to Beno Udrih, he did great things for Memphis. He was there when they needed him. When Nick Calathes got suspended in the 2014 playoffs, I had the chance to cover that whole series for the site. Went to all the home games, covered as a member of the media.
Right.
He cannot – his presence in that series, if it's forgotten, then we have done him a disservice because he was a big reason they got that thing to seven games. But you, at some point, you have to look at it objectively, and you need to say, you know what, Mario Chalmers is a huge upgrade, defensively alone. So to me, in that way, and my concern was, you know, a net negative to being just neutral offensively, which so far looks super wrong. But defensively, the upgrade has never been in question. The fact that he can play and defend multiple positions is what is most attractive to me, because Dave Joerger has shown, and now that Nick Calathes is gone, it's a little bit harder for him to do it, he has shown that he likes those two-point guard lineups, and he wants to play them. And now you have a guy in Mario Chalmers who can defend other team shooting guards. Now you have a guy in Mario Chalmers who you can stick on the best backcourt member of the opposing team at any given time, not lose much defensively, and you can save Mike Conley. He can have energy for offense. He can run off of baseline screens. He can have different plays run for him that he can't run when he's the dominant ball handler on any given offensive set. So it creates versatile opportunity for Mike Conley to create, not just for himself, but for others in different ways. And that is huge for Mike Conley, because he can get caught in situations where it becomes predictable. The pick and roll, you defend the pick and roll a certain way, you hedge, you come off and you help, and all of a sudden, damn, Mike Conley doesn't have anywhere to go. What does he do now? Okay, well, he'll try his little stutter step moves. He'll try a quick little, quick dribble and then step back. His repertoire is not as extensive when he is the primary ball handler and that's all he can do. Now he has somebody that can help him create for himself in other ways, because he can be off the ball more, because he doesn't have to defend the best guy in the backcourt for the opposing team the entire game when it's him and Courtney Lee. You know, if you're playing against Golden State, for example, who I'm watching on TV as we record this, and you've got Steph Curry and you've got, you know, Klay Thompson as your backcourt, you can say, okay, Mario Chalmers, you go defend Steph, and we can hide Mike as much as you can on Klay Thompson. But Klay Thompson is not the dominant, dribble penetrator that Steph is. He's more of a spot-up shooter, kind of a pull-up jumper guy. Mike can defend that a little bit more easily than, say, the energy it would exert to try to control the ridiculous Steph Curry. So that, to me, in stretches, is what will be most valuable for Mike Conley. His ability to be able to catch his breath, be a little bit more selfish, and take shots that he wouldn't get otherwise if there wasn't somebody like a Mario Chalmers on the floor who can be that same kind of dribble penetrator creator for himself and teammates.
All right, so last Grizz thing, because we got some other stuff I want to get through, a lot of stuff to talk about. JaMychal Green has been fantastic. I mean, simply put, he played, I believe, 30 minutes against the Thunder, and his stat line was something like 5 points and 3 rebounds. And if you just look at that stat line for what it's worth, or for what it is, it's not impressive. Playing 30 minutes, scoring 5 points, grabbing 3 boards, it's not good, all right? I mean, and that's why stats lie. They don't tell the whole story, especially those surface-level stats. But Dave Joerger went out of his way in his press conference to praise JaMychal Green, how well he played, and how much they needed that, because they had no Brandon Wright. Zach Randolph got nicked up kind of in the fourth quarter, was dealing with maybe a left knee issue, something like that. He was kind of limping around in the locker room. So they needed JaMychal to play those minutes. He defended well. He hit the biggest three of the ball game, and he grabbed a couple of rebounds when the Grizzlies really needed it. So he's kind of the mold of this new age power forward. I mean, he's got an incredibly high motor. He's a good athlete. He's starting to stretch that shot out to the three-point line and making them. He has made, I think enough at this point where we can recognize that, he's probably going to end up being able to shoot that three at a decently high percentage, or certainly at a high enough percentage that teams are going to have to run a defender at him. So he can kind of stretch the floor out. He can guard multiple positions. You should feel comfortable about, you know, switching defenders on a screen and roll, something like that. So my question for you, Jamichael Green, first of all, how important is he going to be going forward? Because my guess is once Brandon Wright comes back, he's probably going to be your fourth big. And number two, how good can he be?
I think his ceiling, and I've talked to, again, on Three Shades of Blue Radio, we talked about this. I think his ceiling is that of a 2010-2011 Darrell Arthur. And those who have followed the team all the way back to the beginnings of this grit and grind era, you know that is one of the highest compliments you can pay a rotation player. Because 2010-2011, before all the terrible injury, Darrell Arthur was a special basketball player. He was tremendous athletically. He was one of the most dominant pick-and-roll defenders I can ever remember seeing. And he was one of the things that really jumped out at me, because I'm one of those fans who, you know, jumped on the quote-unquote bandwagon with that 2010-2011 season, because that's when my wife and I moved to Memphis, and that's when I was doing my research on, hey, what's going on in Memphis? Oh, the Memphis Grizzlies, they seem cool. Holy crap, I love this basketball team. I love watching them play.
Right.
Darrell Arthur was one of the major reasons for that, because of how he played the game as an athlete, as a defender of the pick and roll, a nice little pick and pop possibility in terms of offensive skill. He was fun to watch. Jamichael Green shows flashes of that. Now, I may have over on Twitter, I think I might have said, oh, he equals this guy, and that's not what I meant. That's his ceiling. That's what he can be, and he has shown flashes of that. And I think that if he is able to be that for these Grizzlies, that is tremendously important, because whether Zach Randolph is hurt or not, even with a healthy Zach Randolph, Zach is not capable of doing that for this team consistently. He might be able to give you a play or two where he gives you that kind of hedge, he gives you that run back, where he's able to kind of defend that pick and roll as effectively as Jamichael does. But it really is amazing what that kind of length and that kind of athleticism can do for you on the defensive end. The ability to switch, which you've seen more and more with Dave Yeager and defensive schemes this season, more than I can remember seeing the past couple of years, it's fascinating to see that you have a guy in Jamichael Green who can defend multiple positions, who can complete those switches more effectively than maybe anybody they've had since DA, and can hedge those pick and rolls more effectively than anybody they've had since DA. And he can create offensive opportunity for himself off of that pick and pop. He can hit that three. He can do things that not meant, like a Brandon Wright obviously has a unique skill set. He's an athlete. When he's healthy, he'll get the minutes he deserves as a backup big, but he can't do some of the things that Jamichael Green can. So if he can play at this level, and if he can get to that DA-esque 2010-2011 kind of play, and just the effort and the motor and the attitude, I again, you can't underestimate that, especially on an NBA team as they go through the grind of the season. If he can keep that motor up, he plays like a guy who knows that his contract ain't guaranteed. You know what I mean? He knows that he can be.
Oh,
you know, he knows that, and he's been to the D League. He's been released by the San Antonio Spurs. He knows none of this is guaranteed for him. So at night in and night out, he plays like he's playing for his job, and that benefits him tremendously because he shows a lot of energy and he shows a lot of desire. And again, that can be contagious for a group of guys like a Mike Conley, like a Marc Gasol. You know, one of the negatives of this group being together so long is you can get complacent very easily. And guys like Mario Chalmers being brought in, new blood, guys like Jamichael Green fighting for their job essentially every night and their life in this league, in this NBA, you know, that can really alter your perspective and can get your energy level up. And that is so valuable. DA did it in the 2010-2011 season. I think Jamichael Green could potentially do that as well for this Grizzlies team.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I thought it was cool last night in the locker room, so everybody wanted to go talk to Jamichael too. And he just kind of sat in this chair that's in front of his locker, and all the media gathered around. And he just had the biggest smile in the world. I mean, this is a guy who has scratched and clawed his way to get to this position where he is. And his contract is still not guaranteed fully for this year. The Grizzlies do not have to do that until later on in January. So he understands, I think, you know, the grind and the rise that he's had to come through, and he's reaping some of the benefits of that, you know. And it's nice to see. Those are stories. Those are guys you can root for. And, you know, not only is he a good story, he's a good player. I mean, flat out, he's a good, useful basketball player. He's a guy that plays incredibly hard and has real basketball skill. You know, you find these guys that'll just, you know, hustle their asses off, but they have no basketball skill. And that's not the case with Jermichael Green. The guy can really play. He's a talented guy. So before we move on, any last Grizzly things you want to talk about?
You touched on it a little bit, but my standard response to early struggles or early successes is call me at Christmas. The rise and fall and the peaks and valleys of these early seasons, you know, and I know Facebook isn't cool to have anymore, but I still have a Facebook page. I'm old enough to where I still have an original Facebook page. The first year Facebook came into existence was my senior year of high school, and I had just been accepted to college. So I was like, oh, I'll sign up for this Facebook thing. But anyway, so I still have my Facebook, and they have the memories feature where you know, it shows you what you posted a year ago, 2 years ago. And last year, and I'll bring it back up as I sit here at my computer, last year on this date, here is something that I posted on Facebook. The Memphis Grizzlies are 10-1 and in first place in the Southwest Division, the Western Conference, and the National Basketball Association. That was November 17th, 2014. But what happened after that, right? I mean, after the All-Star break, they were a 500 basketball team, and they fell apart, and they played well against Portland. But after that series, it was, you know, that was all she wrote. They played poorly throughout the rest of the regular season, especially after the All-Star break. At the very least, you don't know what you have in terms of your team until Christmas. I've heard coaches say that. I've heard media members who have been following the team and know more about it than I do say that. So that's my general rule. I don't get too high. I don't get too low. If your solid sample size on what your team is for any given year is around, as Dave Yeager said, I agree with the 25-game mark, and that puts you right around Christmas, not exactly at Christmas, but that's just my general rule of thumb. Call me at Christmas. Let's see where we're at. If you want to blow up the team then, let's have a conversation about it. If you want to keep everything the way it is and go for another run, let's have a conversation about it. But to get too high or too low, you know, to me is a mistake, because they're still not sure what they're going to be. I mean, Mario Chalmers has no idea what the playbook is yet. Jeff Green has shown the capacity to be terrible for stretches and great for stretches. He's due for a terrible stretch at some point. You just have to be patient, and you have to let this team find out who they are. And as we talked about at the beginning of all of this talk, it's about the story. It's about the journey here. And this team is still finding themselves. They're only 12 games in to an 82-game schedule. They've got 70 to go. And it's going to be a long grind. But that's why you follow sports, is to kind of, you know, see a team grow, see a player grow, see how everything kind of shakes out. And it's easy to fall into the trap of this is what it's going to be, we need to change it. Everybody wants to be right in this 21st century social media blogger world. You know, I've been wrong plenty of times. I've been right sometimes. I'm content with letting other people race to be right, and I want to see what we're working with a fuller sample size around Christmas time.
So that's a very seamless, perfect transition into talking about the Houston Rockets. So this was a team that some people – had pegged to possibly win the most games in the NBA. I know that I heard Bill Simmons on his podcast say that he was he had made a long-term financial investment in that fact, that he thought that the Rockets were going to win the most games in the NBA, get the one seed in the West and get the home court advantage throughout the playoffs. And that it's not to say that still cannot happen, but it does not look good in, you know, the short 10 games that we've played here so far. The Rockets don't look good. They've got a lot of issues. They've also got a lot of talent. So I fully expect them to kind of figure things out and right the ship. But listen, their spacing is really bad. They just functional team. You know, James Harden, he's played okay offensively, but his defense is back to the it's pretty close to a laughable level again. You know, he kind of brought it up from a complete running joke to, okay, he's just a pretty bad defender. And it's gone. It's regressed. It's not as good as it was last season. You know, this was a guy that was he was upset that he didn't win the MVP, I think it's fair to say. And he's not doing any justice to prove that he deserved it over Steph Curry. Dwight Howard, you never know when he's going to play, when he's not going to play. Ty Lawson, who knows if he's ever really going to fit in, and do you even play him over Patrick Beverley, who you kind of know what you're going to get. There's just a lot of questions surrounding this Rockets team. What's been your read on these guys through the first 10 or so games?
Well, their defensive struggles are big. They were one of the better defensive teams in the NBA last year, if I remember correctly. And looking at their points allowed per game right now, they give up 28 points – or excuse me, they're 28th in the league at 108.5 points given up per game. That's not going to cut the mustard. They have some inexcusable losses. They've lost to the Denver Nuggets twice. I understand maybe you split a series with them. I think the Nuggets are better than people thought they would be. But at the same time, to lose to them twice to me is inexcusable. They lost to the Brooklyn Nets. One of the only wins that the Nets have had this season was against the Houston Rockets. They lost a home game, it might have been tonight actually, against the Boston Celtics. They lose to Boston. You know, it's fascinating to see them lose to teams that, again, might be better than we all realized, might be in a place to where they can compete at a higher level than they may have been able to in the past. But you have to, at the same time, and that game was from last night, excuse me, you have to at the same time be able to say, you know, this was a team, as you said, Chip, was projected to be, you know, a top two or three team in the West. I said that. I thought Houston was going to win the division, and I kind of had them as a team that would again face Golden State in the Western Conference Finals. You can't regress this mightily. But at the same time, going back and being fair and using our Grizzlies logic for the Houston Rockets, call me a Christmas. You know, this is a team that has also had to play Golden State. This is a team that has had to play some tough schedules. So it's not an entirely lost situation for Houston. But to me, their issues are getting Ty Lawson integrated. You know, their offense is so based off of James Harden running that show and running that ship and being a ball dominant guard. Ty Lawson playing off the ball is not like a Mike Conley playing off the ball. They don't have the same kind of offensive, you know, repertoire in terms of running off of screens, in terms of just playing as a, you know, a second off the ball shoot point guard or as a shooting guard, quote unquote. You know, that's different for Ty. That hasn't been what he's been asked to do in the past. So I think that's a learning curve for him. I think that you see Dwight Howard, you know, not being the defensive presence that he was in the past, not being that dominant defender in the lane. I think that you see a bench that isn't as good as maybe they thought it would be. As crazy as this sounds, they might miss Josh Smith more than we realized in terms of his energy, in terms of his versatility off the bench as a defender and as a player for them. There's issues there, but at the same time, it call me a Christmas. You know, let's see where they're at, you know, in a month or so. Let's see where their record is. They're 4-7 right now. I'd be surprised if they were 4-7 come, or if they had a win percentage, excuse me, of 36.4 come Christmas time. It certainly bears watching that they're not a team that should really be overly concerned or panic. They need to make some adjustments. They need to kind of – they had the dreaded players-only meeting today, it sounds like. But we'll see if that actually – how that works out for them. But
right.
I see it as a situation. They're too talented to stay as low as they are. I think they'll probably rise up. It all kind of regresses back to the mean, as we talked about earlier. I don't see Dallas as a 7-4, 63.6% win percentage team for the entirety of the season. I think Memphis and Houston will kind of rise back up the standings. Dallas will fade, probably take that 7 or 8 seed maybe that New Orleans was going to take if they were able to stay healthy. And that'll be how it'll work out. I think Houston and Memphis, you know, especially Houston, but the slow start will hamper them a little bit. They'll be competing for that second, third place slot in the Southwest Division.
All right, so if I told you for the next decade you can have anybody's roster in the NBA. You can't make any trades. You just, that's the roster you're going to have for the next 10 years. Would you take anyone outside of the Minnesota Timberwolves? Because that's who I'm taking, but I'm curious who you take.
Well, I tend to like Golden State. I like Klay Thompson. I like the idea of re-signing Harrison Barnes if they're able to do it. I think Steph Curry and Draymond Green, you know, they fit that modern NBA that everybody likes to wax, you know, futuristically about. And I think Golden State is pretty solid. If we're talking about specific parts of rosters, I think I would take the Wizards backcourt of John Wall and Bradley Beal before I would take that of Minnesota. I really like what they're doing with their backcourt in Washington, and they're having a good run of success. They're a pretty good basketball team right now. So I would take John Wall and Bradley Beal for my backcourt. In terms of frontcourt, I like what Utah's doing. I think Rudy Gobert favors. I think Gordon Hayward, you know, that's going to be a formidable frontcourt to have to deal with for the next 5 to 10 years, a relatively young crew of guys. But to answer your question fully, in terms of full roster, you got Andrew Wiggins, you got Karl Anthony Towns. You know, you've got a lot of talented dudes that can play a lot of different styles, and they're going to grow up together, and that's going to be cool to see, to watch unfold. So whoever gets that job permanently, it'll be a great gig for that coach because they're going to, you know, have a lot of growth on their hands. But I think that you can make an argument for Minnesota. I don't think that you're crazy for feeling the way that you do there, Chip. I personally am a fan of, like I said, I would go Golden State just because of Steph Curry. If they keep him locked down for years upon years upon years, I think you can put a lot of pieces around him. He's just a different animal in terms of scoring the basketball. But, you know, Karl Anthony Towns, you know, LaVine had a good game against Memphis. You got Wiggins. You've got Shabazz. You've got a bunch of different pieces there in Minnesota. You have a lot, especially the two massive building blocks of Karl Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins. You know, that's something to certainly build on.
That's the thing. I think sooner rather than later, Karl Anthony Towns is going to be a top 10 NBA player. Like, maybe even within the next 2 years, he is going to be the best center in the NBA, and he's going to be a top 10 overall NBA player. And depending on how the development of Wiggins goes, I don't think it's crazy to think that he could end up as a top 15 to 20 player in the NBA. So I think that you could have something like the top two of the 15 best players in the NBA within the next 5 years, and then you get the 5 years of their prime, and you just kind of figure out how to work that around them. I have no idea Zach LaVine is going to be, Zach LaVine, however you say his name, going to be right. A good NBA player. He's certainly a fun athlete. You've certainly kind of got a big blank slate to work with in terms of teaching him how to play. You see that they're really experimenting with him at the point guard position. We saw that a lot against the Grizzlies. Because if he is able to play that point guard position, you know, you can then probably flip Ricky Rubio for something else. So Gorgui Jang's a nice piece there. Shabazz Muhammad, it's possible that he could be a nice piece there. I like that roster. I really do. And I should have said a non-playoff/rebuilding team. I should have said that because, yeah, you're right. Given the Warriors roster, maybe even the Thunder roster, you know, that's tough to say, right? You know, you've got the Thunder roster. You may have two of the five best NBA players in the planet, you know, with the Thunder. And then the Warriors, just the way that they're rolling right now. But, all right, so I'll rephrase the question, and I'll put you a bit on the spot. Out of any of the teams that are non-playoff/rebuilding mode, is anybody set up for success over the next decade better than the Timberwolves?
No. When you put the question like that, no. It's Minnesota with a bullet. I like Utah. I think they would be an honorable mention in that category. But no, I think Minnesota is a team that really is poised to rise. And I think I made a joke about it on Twitter. You look at their roster, and it's almost like a high school mentoring program with an elementary school in a local community.
Yeah.
You've got Kevin Garnett, Tayshaun Prince, Andre Miller, Kevin Martin, all of these veteran guys playing with essentially these babies. But that's great for them. You know, that's great learning experiences to be able to be with these veterans. And they're good veterans, too. I mean, you know, people were hard on Tayshaun Prince during his time in Memphis, especially towards the end.
but you're not going to see or find a more professional guy than Tayshaun Prince. Same thing with Kevin Garnett. I mean, people love Kevin Garnett, think he's going to be a great coach if that's the road he wants to go down someday. Andre Miller, Kevin Martin, you know, these are all guys that are valuable pieces for these young dudes to learn from. So credit to the Minnesota Timberwolves organization. They're going young. They've made the most out of trading away a franchise player in Kevin Love. And they're also setting themselves up to have veterans teach these young guys, here's what it means to be a professional basketball player, and here's how you should carry yourself accordingly.
And I think that's what the vision of the late Flip Saunders wants, you know, to kind of pair those older guys with the younger guys and show them how to win, show them how to be NBA players. And so by the time those older guys are ready to retire, they've spent a couple of years with these veteran guys, they've learned the game, and here they are. You kind of hand the reins over, and that's what Flip wanted to do. And I think that's pretty cool. I think that's something a little bit different that not a lot of teams have done. Maybe some have tried, but, I mean, they have literally paired up almost man for man. I mean, you look at pairing up Garnett with Towns or Kevin Martin / Tayshaun Prince with Andrew Wiggins and then Andre Miller with Zach LaVine. I mean, it's astonishing how they were able to kind of make that all work perfectly and have, you know, basically a guy at the three major spots, point guard, wing, and big man, to have those mentors there in place for those young players. So I think that roster is a lot of fun. That is a fun problem to have, trying to figure out how to make all those young guys work, because they got some serious talent. I'm telling you, Towns is a monster. I mean, he is unbelievable. And like I said, sooner rather than later, you're going to consider that guy. My guess would be he's going to be the top center in the NBA, or at least one of the top two or three with Boogie Cousins and Andre Drummond. And, you know, you would expect over the next three or so years, Marc Gasol begins to regress off the mountain that he's been on the last couple of years. But, yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun to watch those guys grow. So, okay, I asked you to make a couple of picks against the spread. You got those picks ready for me? These are Wednesday night games against the spread.
For you. And I ask you to be gentle with me if I do this wrong, because I'm not much of a gambler.
No, it's totally fine.
So I did a little research, and I think I have a couple of good picks. And I'm taking the points in both of them. I'm hoping I'm using this lingo properly. I'm looking at the games. Toronto is at Utah. And Chicago is at Phoenix. Utah is a 4.5-point favorite against Toronto, and Phoenix is a 2.5-point favorite against Chicago. I'm taking the points for Chicago and Toronto in both of those. So I think Toronto will either win or cover against Utah, and I think Chicago will either win or cover against Phoenix. And again, I hope that I was right when I did that.
No. But, you're perfect. That's great.
Okay.
Listen, the main goal of this podcast is just to get everybody to gamble irresponsibly on every NBA game. That's really what I want to have happen. No, I actually looked at the Chicago Phoenix one.
Thanks for that.
Oh, hey, that's what I'm here to do, Joe. I'm here to make sure everybody has a good time. Listen, I just want the Mullinexes to have a good Christmas, and there's only one way to make that
happen.
There you go. Let's make sure that we...
Maybe needs a new pair of everything, right? Yeah, that's right.
That's right. So the Chicago Phoenix one I actually like. I almost took the points with Chicago because I don't know. I mean, that feels like a pretty good Chicago team getting points. I mean, I'm fine with Chicago getting points against a mediocre West team in Phoenix. But no issue there. The Toronto one, I'm pretty fine with. The rule, or one of the rules I usually abide by, although not always, is I kind of stay away from the second night of back-to-back teams, and that's what Toronto's going to be on after playing the Warriors. But Toronto's a good basketball team. So taking them getting points, I have no issue with. The two I went with, and I didn't feel great about either one, Kings getting four at the Atlanta Hawks. The Atlanta Hawks are also going to be on the second night of a back-to-back. Jeff Teague will not play. So the Kings getting four. They're playing a team, like I said, second night or back-to-back, don't have their usual point guard. I'll take the points. And then, who's my other one here? Oh, Mavs getting five at the Celtics. This feels like two relatively even teams. I think that the Mavs and Celtics are pretty close to even. There's no, you know, back-to-back nights working or anything here. They just feel like relatively even teams, and in those type of games, if you can get 5 points, that feels like a pretty good number. So I don't know if you have a bone to pick with either of mine, but I thought yours were fine.
No, I like yours too. I think those are pretty solid. And just from the brief research I did, which unfortunately I have to be honest, part of that was reading something that Gary Parrish did, because I remember from my time in Memphis, he's a bit of a degenerate gambler,
like
Chris Vernon and the others are. A piece of advice that he gave was anytime it's 4 or less points, maybe you take the points, and that's not a terrible play. So
right.
That's what I went with. I kind of looked for those, and I knew that Chicago, even without Derrick Rose, I watched Phoenix play a little bit last night as I was staying up late to work on the Jeff Green piece. They're good.
Yeah.
They're coming off of an energetic, big game for Brandon Wright, and he's due to go down a little bit. So that was my general thought process.
Yeah, I like I said, I almost picked that Chicago one. Just go ahead and take the points and, just hope that they cover. You feel like they probably win the game outright, so getting points, you feel good about there. So I want to switch gears, spend maybe 10 minutes talking about football, because I know you're a football coach. That's what you do. That's how you pay the bills. And I'm not sure
that
everybody's
job.
Totally aware of that. Yeah, but that's the day job. So quick thoughts on Memphis and Justin Fuente, Paxton Lynch. First of all, I just saw Memphis is actually, they're still ranked in the college football playoff, I believe 22nd.
21.
At 8-2. 21, okay. So coming off a loss, they're still ranked. The committee obviously has a lot of respect for the Tigers. They didn't take a bad loss. In fact, they had a kick to win the game at the end. I think Memphis fans are going to be pretty happy about that, but first, just kind of your general thoughts on Memphis as a whole, and then maybe the futures of Paxton Lynch and Justin Fuente.
Well, first off, Fuente is a hell of a football coach, and I applauded that hire when it was made. Anybody coming from TCU, Gary Patterson, again, a hell of a football coach. I've always liked the way that he runs his program. He gets athletes. He makes them football players. He fits them and molds them into what he wants, and he's also extremely organized, extremely disciplined. And that is something that Fuente is as well. So I knew that it was a good hire when they made it. And even in the early struggles and the startings of Paxton Lynch over the piano man, as he was lovingly called, and all of that, people were hating on Fuente at that moment, at that time. But, he was playing the long game. He was playing long ball. He was looking at the macro view of things. And I don't think anybody's questioning his decision-making at this point after that. So Fuente's a hell of a football coach. And Paxton Lynch is a hell of a quarterback. I think that you've seen some flaws in his game the past couple of games. He forces things every once in a while, which is typical of a young football player, regardless of position. He sometimes will look at his read and not fully finish it out. And what I mean by that is he'll take a look at a high safety or he'll take a look at a coverage that he thinks he has, and he'll be so locked in on what he thinks he has that he doesn't, fully comprehend his secondary key. This is all higher level things that he'll continue to develop and get. It's not something that makes you say, oh, Paxton Lynch is a terrible football player. He clearly is not. But these are things that can separate you in terms of being a first, quarterback taken overall and a second, third, fourth quarterback taken overall, which could be the difference in millions of dollars, or in the case of Paxton Lynch, whether or not you even come out or whether you stay for one more season at Memphis. I think that their futures are actually connected. I think that Paxton Lynch will stay if Fuente stays. If Fuente's gone, I think Lynch will leave. And that's bad and good for Memphis. If both of those guys stay, Memphis could legitimately have a chance at making, I don't want to get everybody super fired up at me, but the college football playoff would be a legitimate conversation. This year I thought it was a bit of a stretch to ever put them in that category. But if you have Lynch back as a senior, I believe he'd be a senior, and if you have Fuente back in, another year with another recruiting class, another year of development in their program, you can have a serious top 15 conversation. If your team is one of the top 15 in the country, you're in that college football playoff talk legitimately. So I am impressed with both of those guys. I think that they're building something pretty special there in Memphis, and hopefully he'll stick around to carry it out. There's some good jobs that'll be available. South Carolina comes to mind. Missouri comes to mind. You'll also have, of course, the vaunted Virginia Tech job with the retirement of Frank Beamer. I'm telling everybody
right
out here that will listen that they need to throw as much money as possible at Justin Fuente and get him to come
yeah
to Blacksburg. But if I were Fuente, I would take one of those Big 12 or SEC jobs, or I would stay and just hope that in the next year or so your programs are able to make the leap into one of those major conferences on your own.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, how much of Justin Fuente's decision will be impacted by what Paxton Lynch decides to do. If, you know, Paxton decides, you know, I'm going to come back, does that make Fuente – does that make the Memphis job that much more attractive for Fuente to say, okay, I can wait at least another year and see what else comes open if there's nothing that I'm liking at the moment? Or if Paxton's leaving, saying, okay, you know, maybe I take a Virginia Tech job that I might not, that I might have passed up on if Paxton stayed this year. So I don't know. I do think – I think you're right. I think that in some way, either one way or the other, their fates are kind of connected. You know, whether, you know, it's Justin Fuente's decision affecting what Paxton does affecting what Coach Fuente does. So it'll be interesting to play out, but I know that everybody here in Memphis is ecstatic for the way this football season's gone. Even though it's been disappointing the last couple of weeks, 8-2 for a Memphis football program that, you know, won one or two games during the Larry Porter years, that I think they're fine. I think they'll be okay with a couple of losses to two top 25 teams. So I want to ask you about the team that I root for usually. That's the Tennessee Volunteers. Listen, for a while there, the Tennessee Volunteers, listen, I'll say they're a good football team. You could get really good Vegas numbers on them, like really, really good, because they were getting some disrespect. I mean, they had a losing record, and, you know, justifiably so. I think, you know, they were 2-3 football team, maybe a 3-4 football team. That's indicative of not a great football team. But if you take a look at the losses that they had and the way that those games were lost, Tennessee could very easily be a 1 or even 2-loss football team. Or, honestly, they had a lead in the fourth quarter of every single game that they lost. So they could really they could be undefeated. But in all fairness, they're probably a 1-2-loss team that just happens to have 4 losses. So you could get some really good numbers. I think that with their recent success, you know, sticking with Alabama, blowing out Kentucky, the Vegas has kind of backed off on saying Tennessee, yeah, they're a good team. We'll give them respect. But as those losses started to pile up early on in the season and the way that Tennessee lost those games, there were people that started to jump ship on Butch Jones, saying that he's some people call him the Josh Pastner of college football. You know, he can recruit, he can get the guys there, but once they're there, he chokes. He doesn't know how to coach. He makes coaching blunders all the time. As a guy that does this for a living, was that fair to say, and is that still fair to say?
I think it's fair to say to an extent. I think that if
okay
anybody who rises up the coaching ranks, whether it be a Brian Kelly who kind of started off in smaller schools and just went from job to job to job until he got to, you know, the great job of Notre Dame, or whether it's a Tennessee with Butch Jones, because that's a very good job historically, especially being in the SEC East. Any somewhat major job in the SEC East is a great job because you don't have to deal with the damn West. But
right,
it's something that he clearly does not fully understand time management from the little bit that I've been able to see and a little bit of research I've done. It seems like he's had issues with that in the past. It seems like he gets comfortable in his play calling. He relies too much on his quarterback or on a certain player. He gets predictable. And for any coach at any level of any sport, predictability is one of your biggest enemies that you want to try to avoid. You don't want to It's very easy to get into a 4th-and-2 situation, get into a 3rd-and-long situation and say, okay, here's our bread and butter. We know how to do this. Well, guess what? The guy on the opposing sideline, if he's worth his salt, has put in his time in the fill room, and he knows what your favorite play is in that situation, and he's going to do what he needs to do, run whatever coverage it is, you know, whatever play it is if it's on offense, to take advantage of your predictability. So it comes down to taking these athletes that you recruit, as you said, he's clearly a good recruiter, taking these
right.
athletes, putting them again in the positions to be successful, and being able to vary what you do so that you keep your opponents on your on their heels. And he doesn't do that consistently, at least from what I've seen. He relies heavily on running that quarterback, and that's not consistently going to do it for you. You're going to bang up your guy. You're going to make it so that he is the focal point. And anytime you have one guy who's the focal point, if you take that away, you get, again, into predictable situations in those, you know, third and long, second and long spots. Well, me as a defensive coordinator, I'm teeing off on you. I know what you're going to do. It's when you're in
right.
third and four, third and three, staying on schedule, as offensive coordinators will say. That's when you're making a defense kind of guess and pick and choose what you're going to do, and that's when you can really attack and have success. But if you're too predictable, you're staying off schedule, and then you're putting your offense in a position where the defense can kind of take advantage of you, whereas it should be the other way around.
All right, last thing, I want to get your thoughts on the college football playoff. So they literally just released these rankings as we began to record this podcast. Top six in order are Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, Notre Dame, Iowa, Oklahoma State. Any issue there?
No, not really. I think I said this on
okay.
Twitter, looking at the top 10, I would probably flip Oklahoma State and Iowa, but that's, you know, that's splitting hairs. I think Notre Dame continues to kind of get a little bit too much love. That's a Notre Dame team that I saw almost lose to UVA. And again, I like UVA, but anytime at football, if you're in a top four situation in the country and you almost lost to UVA, I lose a little respect for you. Ohio State is kind of in the Florida State boat. They should be in the top four until they lose from last year because they're the defending champ. Clemson's been damn impressive from watching them play. They've been a very good football team, defensively and offensively. Lots of athletes, lots of speed. I have no issues with the top four as of right now. I mean, Notre Dame being
okay.
there, take it or leave it. But I like Oklahoma State a lot. It looks like it'll come down to Oklahoma State and Oklahoma, who could potentially get that final spot or to be the next Big 12 team that's left out of the entire situation. It's possible that Clemson, as the ACC representative, loses in the ACC championship game. Right now, it looks
right.
like that'll be North Carolina coming out of the Coastal. I'll see them play live this weekend. I'm going to the Virginia Tech game with my wife and her family. But it's going to be tough for Clemson. North Carolina is very good. They run a complicated offense. They've got a lot of athletes, high tempo, and it'll be something that Clemson hadn't seen a ton of, at least from their ACC opponents, to this point this season. So Clemson is ripe for the picking. Alabama and Auburn, obviously, that major rivalry game, that's always hard. And then the SEC championship, Florida would be competing for what they see as a potential spot in that playoff if they could knock off Alabama, if Alabama does indeed get to the SEC championship game. Ohio State has Michigan State this weekend. They can get beat by Michigan State very easily. You know, so it's all over the place. It'll all take care of itself. But in terms of the top 10, aside from flipping Iowa and Ohio State, or Oklahoma State, excuse me, I don't have an issue with it at all.
All right, gun to your head. Who's the top four when it matters?
Top four when it matters. I'm going to say Alabama's number one. I'm going to say Ohio State is number two. I'm going to say Oklahoma State is number three. And I'm going to say that we'll go Notre Dame number four because they won't lose
okay.
and they'll just keep them at that stop. Spot. So I'll say Alabama, Ohio State, we'll go Oklahoma State, and we'll go Notre Dame. Those will be my four. And it could very well be Oklahoma. I'll do a cop-out on that one. Whoever
yeah.
wins that game will be in the playoff, I think. They're not going to screw the Big 12 over 2 years in a row.
All right. He is Joe Mullinex. You can follow him on Twitter at Joe Mullinex, right? It's just at Joe Mullinex. No,
at Joe Mullinex. No, that's me. Short and sweet and easy.
Beautiful. All right, Joe Mullinex, you'll have GBB Live Thursday. I would imagine you'll have the Friday threes on Friday. Anything else to plug?
Nope, that'll be it. GBB Live Thursday, Friday three column on Friday. And, Chip, I appreciate you having me on, man. I appreciate the show. I like it. Again, I like that we're adding to our Blog Talk Radio repertoire over at grizzlybearblues.com. You do a good job with it. and I'll continue to follow it and listen, and I look forward to the next time I'm on the program.
Much appreciated, Joe. We'll do it again, all right, man? Thanks a bunch.
Of course, Chip. Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
All right, bye.